Thank you so much for joining me today on the Picture House podcast. So I am so excited to talk to you about Titane. My feeling is that this film is a real game changer on so many levels. But can we please start with winning the Palme d'Or, what that meant to you and what that means for women in film?
Yeah, so the Palme d'Or, personally, I mean, as a filmmaker, obviously, before I received it, it meant everything. I mean, for me, that was like the biggest recognition one could ever have in their lifetime for their work. And for me, I mean, honestly, I did not believe it was real until quite recently. And I'm not sure I completely processed it. All I can tell you is that I was filled with an immense joy on stage when I received it. And I think, again, I mean, at the moment, I was completely, you know, taken aback and surprised, and it was very hard to think straight. But what I felt on stage after hugging Sharon Stone and trying to put words on what I was feeling is that I kept thinking about Jane Campion, you know, because I was so looking for words and looking for ways to react, because that was a lot. I thought about her and I wondered, how did she feel? You know, like, maybe she could tell me how she felt, because that would help me. And I thought, you know, the thing is that being the second woman receiving the Palme d'Or, I had the luxury not to be an exception anymore. And she was an exception, and she remained an exception for a long time. And I do believe that she must have felt very alone in that. And being the second one, that is something that I repeated myself over and over, means that there's going to be a third one. So I was not alone. I was with Jane, and I was with the next one already, and maybe the fourth one as well, and so on. So there was this like incredible feeling of being in a forward movement, you know, for women.
I think so. And it feels very much led by French directors as well. You have Céline Sciamma and Alice Winocur, all of you coming up with these extraordinary films with fabulous new narratives that are off the scale, you know, like really reinventing cinema. And I just can't help thinking that you're quite right. This is number three won't be far behind you, because things are changing really quickly.
That's what I think. It's not going to take 28 years again.
No, absolutely not. Yes. And so to Titane, I'm going to be completely fangirl here, I'm afraid. So it is one of the most exquisitely crafted, unique, unexpected, specific, and dare I say spiritual portrayals of true love I have ever seen.
Thank you so much, because honestly, that was the biggest challenge of the film for me. I mean, talking about love is something that I tackled the subject a little bit in Raw, but it was a side subject really, because it was really a one-person story, and it was all about her emancipation through cannibalism. But I thought, I should try to put love at the center of a story, knowing that I would probably fail. It's hard to talk about love for me. I mean, for a lot of people, it comes very naturally and some, but I have this kind of shyness towards this feeling that I believe is so transcending, you know, everything. And that I think is so rare that I did not want to put words on it, you know. So you talking about this, I mean, saying this, these words, is very gratifying for me, because it means that I managed to do something that I thought was undoable by me.
To be honest, I think it's undoable by most people, because when you're actually talking about the specificity of that moment when one is truly seen, it is almost, I mean, the only way I've heard it described before is almost by people when they meet a guru, like when Ram Dass met his guru and he is seen. And it is something that I do believe people don't know how to talk about. And the Hollywoodizing of love has made our shame about not feeling that Hollywood standard of love, very difficult to talk about.
Yeah, you're right. I agree with you. There is something, yeah, if you don't know love at first sight, if you don't feel that it's like an easy breezy feeling or anything, it does feel that you're a bit crippled somehow. And that's how I felt, actually. And you know what, you saying that it's about like trying to pinpoint the moment where someone feels seen for the first time is so accurate as far as my film is concerned, because it's really all about looks, and it's all about the fact that she's never been looked at before, and that he actually just looks at her at the beginning in this like mental lie of fantasy that he tries to organize and to orchestrate around her, and trying to make her look like his lost son and all that. But how in the end, I mean, it's like their proximity and the fact that they start needing each other to survive makes him like peel the skins or the layers of his look in order to have a real look on her, like a real one that sees right into her and beyond all representation and all lies. And that's exactly what my movie is about. Man, you're good.
Oh. I'm so pleased. Honestly, Julie, I've been agonizing about how to ask you the questions about the unquestionable, about the unspeakable. So it's really, really been the film has stayed with me so much. And I also feel that you demonstrated with superb efficiency Alexa's relationship with her family and with her father. And all that we needed to know was in those first few frames of his disgust with her, that we will never know what went on for him that he would look at her this way. But children absorb what their parents give them. And his frame of reference, I felt, permeated her being as I am disgusting.
Well, I do, yeah, absolutely. And I think that even like, I think more than this, I think the fact that he does not look at her or in biased way, like through the rearview mirror or through the bars at the window, there is always an obstacle in his look, or if there are none, then he's looking away and he's just ignoring her. And which comes for me really is the biggest violence there is in the film. And if you think about it, the damages that it causes are really like extremely immense. And I do believe that that makes a character, and actually I've written her. I have a character that I've always thought she has no contours. Like she's not channeled, she's not finite. She's like this kind of like, you know, vapid somehow being. And she's only driven by impulses. And so impulses overflow from her in every direction in a very chaotic way because she's never been looked at. So she has no contour. She cannot be, you know, defined in some way because no one defines her. And yeah, that really goes with what you're saying. That's good.
Yes, I totally get my inaccuracy by saying he looked at her with disgust. He looked away with disgust. He never. And if you don't have that, if you're not framed in someone's vision, then you almost don't know how to exist. You can't contain yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. On the other direction, obviously Vincent's character is like negative or positive, whatever, or just an echo to that. I say negative or positive because I really want to insist on the fact that I do not consider Vincent as being her savior, and I do not consider him the white knight. I think he's a very, very disturbed character at the beginning. He's very dark. I think the way he kind of overbears on her and in a very intrusive way, trying to make her be someone that she is not and that he knows she's not, is extremely mad. But in his madness, the thing is that he looks at her constantly, in a very, very prevalent and intrusive way. But the thing is that his look is at the beginning, as I said, it's a look that is lying, that is a fantasy. It's like he's not looking at her at all. He's looking at his son, his lost son. And that look is gonna evolve, which is like the whole redemptive arc somehow that Vincent has. But it is all about looks. It's really like someone who doesn't look, and someone who looks too much, like way too much, but at the same time it gives her contours.
Yes, and it's the first time that she's able to, if you like, push back and shape herself within, you know, whether she's his son or whether she's Alexia, she's getting something and she's giving something in a relationship that she's obviously never ever had before. And I loved how she was able to observe that Vincent was lovable, like all his men or his firefighter men loved him. I'm really intrigued why you chose him to be a firefighter. I thought it was perfect occupation for him.
Well, there are two reasons that are pretty simple. The first one is that I chose for both of them a very stereotypical jobs. Like firefighters are always associated with masculinity, which is stupid because you have a lot of female firefighters, but well, that's another story. And her being an exotic dancer is also typically associated with femininity. And the idea was to have these two characters who could have remain the stereotypes that they seem to represent, but that I tried to kill it. I tried to really like take this stereotype and just try to debunk them with the light, with the sound, with the action, obviously. In all fairness, like he's always bathed in pink, obviously pink being constantly the kind of socially admitted color for femininity, which is completely stupid. I put it on the firefighter. And the blue is for her, obviously. And this is this kind of, every time I play with stereotypes, I just kill them. I just, no, that can go the other way around. That's bullshit. And the second reason is that me being influenced by the Greek myth of Gaia and Uranus mating and creating the Titans and Titanites, I wanted in my film to be, in the mythology of my film, to be with two foundational materials such as metal and fire, to portray this kind of mythological aspect of the story. And obviously fire can melt metal, which is also a good thing.
Yes. And there's such an aspect to it all that felt very mythical and very almost fairy tale, and yet so sort of brutal and real and very founded in reality.
Yeah, I think when you personally, because I do not want there to be a distance between the audience and my characters and the audience and my story, and yet I know I'm telling a story that is very, very far-fetched and that borderline sci-fi. If you want to minimize as much as you can this distance that we have to fairy tales, that we have to sci-fi and all that, you know, this thing like, oh, that doesn't concern us, it's not our world. Well, I'm creating my own world, but I want this distance to disappear. I want you to be completely immersed in my world and in their shoes. And so the more extravagant, if you want, the situation is, the more realistic my references are going to be. Like, for example, everything with prosthetic was working with Olivier Afonso, who's been my prosthetic master since junior, sorry, since a very long time. We've been working on skin a lot together, like a lot. And all the time, all my references are medical. I always give him medical images, medical videos, in order to show him what it should look like. But we add an edge, we add a strangeness, an uncanny to that it's gonna make you feel at home in, you know, in terms of what you recognize, and at the same time puts you off track. So it's really this balance between it.
Yeah, and the prosthetics, the absolute exactness of the prosthetics, I mean, they were incredible. When you see the oil seeping through it, it is so visceral and real. There is nothing about it that isn't happening to that woman.
You know, that, I mean, that was real. I mean, all this was like shot live, and she had like pipes behind the back going into the prosthetics for the breast and all that. And all this was shot live. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely extraordinary. And I mean, I love that you describe the film as an arrow, and it's so precise and clean. And the energies that bring Alexia and Vincent together. Can you tell me about that energy, about how it is in real life? It is what we do, isn't it? We somehow create our destiny.
No, I don't believe in that. That's the thing for me. The idea of destiny is another determinism. I don't believe that you are set on a path. And actually, I'm trying to prove the contrary, not prove, but to portray the contrary, to convey the idea that there are so many paths that we can go down, you know, and that I believe in chaos, and I do believe that they have been brought by chaos together, because the chaos is the chaos of her life before that we've seen, and that somehow is like a pinball. Like if you think about the killing spree and all that in the house, I mean, she is completely pushed by, she's only in reaction to things. She's being pushed by, it's just chaos. I mean, one little thing is going to add to, so is going to become something else. Like she kills one, they're going to be four that are coming. And that's not the situation. And she did not expect to kill her parents, but yet she has to. And she did not expect to that, but she has to. And it's pure chaos that brought them. But I think that the only thing that can, and it's only retrospect, but the only thing that can make you believe that it's destiny is just because they ended up loving each other. But if they hadn't, it would have remained chaos. I just think that love brings order to things, you know, somehow in retrospect. But I don't believe that it's destiny, because no, it's clearly they were not meant to meet. They were not meant to love each other. But I believe in humanity, you see. I'm an optimist.
Yes, and I felt that. And yes, it's interesting. I suppose, yeah, I can see that from the chaos, they were, the likelihood of them meeting each other is just extraordinary.
That's the thing. It's like the reason why it feels so fit, which it does not at the beginning, because at the beginning she's constantly disclosed of killing him, and she goes away and she goes back and all that. But I think that in the end, it's just that they are alone and they need each other. First for survival, both of them, and they use each other in order to survive. And then because they start needing this company, you know, and these looks that they have on each other. It's because they're alone that it's fit. They're really alone.
Yes. And with your two lead actors, I mean, I know that you wrote the part for Vincent, and I loved that he said that he read it with his heart. And I can really empathize with that, because when I watched it, I have to say, I watched it with my whole body. And I didn't realize until I finished the film that I was completely curled up and my stomach hurt, and I hadn't breathed properly. Throughout the whole film. It is such a visceral film. And with your lead actress, she is just every part of her. I mean, I can say that, could I say that she's like De Niro?
Oh. Okay. Maybe it's a bit too soon. Maybe it's a bit too soon. I don't know.
But I suppose it reminded me of both Taxi Driver and Bad Lieutenant in a way.
Yeah. Oh, that's Harvey Keitel in Bad
Lieutenant. Right, yes, and De Niro in Taxi Driver.
And he was a reference for Vincent. I gave him as a reference to Vincent in terms of heavy lifting and stuff. I gave him the poster for Bad Lieutenant, and I say, you look at this, and I want you to look like that, so you look at this when you work out.
Oh, brilliant. I mean, there were so many films that I thought, oh my God, this is reminding me of this, but it's a woman, and it's that's so exciting, you know. And so tell me about working with Agatha. She was fabulous.
We met through regular casting, I guess. Like from the get-go, I knew I wanted to work with non-professional person. I was looking for a very, very specific look that was obviously androgynous. And for that reason, we started with my director of cast looking through Instagram of androgynous models, both male and female. Because at this, I mean, I didn't care really for this part. It could have been a man or a woman playing it, because I was so precise in what I wanted in terms of feature and what I could film for the part. And I made her come back like five rounds or six rounds, I think it was a long casting for her and for me, because it was 6 months for me. I think that the main thing when you're casting non-professional actors or actresses, that you're not looking for a performance that's going to make you wow, that's going to nail you to the floor, because you know that they haven't played before and that it's their first time, and it's normal. You're looking for potential and you're looking for someone you actually crave to film. And Agathe, after the fifth time, and I knew it from the start, but I needed to see how far she could go, I just wanted to film her so much because she has crazy features. You can like change camera angles and she's gonna look like a different person. It works as well with the light. She's constantly changeable, you know, she has a very interesting look. And after that, it was a year of working on her acting together and on her physicality with dancing, boxing, because she needed to learn how to fight in order to play someone who can be actually dangerous. And that's it. I mean, a lot of work. Obviously, her part being quite almost mute. We worked on the script of other films, in monologues mainly, that I chose because they had like a big range of emotions, such as like Sidney Lumet's Network, the monologue, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore. On Twin Peaks as well, with Adonna's monologue over Laura's grave. We worked on Killing Eve as well a lot with monologues from Villanelle. And so, yeah, we worked like this for a year, and it was also like a year of making her aware of what the film was going to require and how physical it was going to be and how long it was going to take and all that. Yeah.
I appreciate how absolutely painstaking the film was. Julia DeConnor, it's been such a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.